Continuing in Mitzvah Shimem Zion 347, which is the mitzvah to use the services of an Eved Kenani, a non-Jewish servant, remember, who's undergone the quasi-conversion forever. That's the way, that's what's called an Eved Kenani. And you're not allowed to free him under normal circumstances. Midini ha-mitzvah, ma-sha-amru zichronem levracha, shu-kone atzmo be-kesef u-vishtar shichur uverashe evarin she'enan chozrin. So the reason this is discussed in Maseches Kiddushin, as we see the little citation here, is because famously the Mishnah in Maseches Kiddushin begins that one acquires a wife in one of three ways, and she acquires the dissolution of the marriage in two ways. Meaning you acquire, the marriage can be contracted through money, through a document, or through having relations. And a marriage is dissolved by either a get or the death of the husband. There are only two ways a Jewish marriage can be terminated. So, for a slave, the reason that is discussed here in Kiddushin is because it says that a slave can acquire his freedom in the same way that a woman acquires a termination of a marriage by those two ways. So, it's not saying that the reason that it's discussed in Kiddushin is not because it's like a marriage when you acquire a slave, but rather it's just going with the theme of a person acquiring the end of a type of relationship. So a slave acquires the end of his relationship with the master by three ways, either by paying money for his own freedom. If he manages to acquire some money of his own accord, then he can pay his master for his freedom if the master agrees. Again, the master doesn't have to agree to that. Yeah?
How can the slave acquire money on his own?
So somebody else would have to give him the money and say, here, this is for you in order to redeem yourself. And if in other words, normally, when a slave acquires an object, the slave doesn't have an independent ability to acquire possession of objects. So if he acquires something, so it automatically becomes the property of the master. But here, when you person gives him the money with the explicit intention that the master should not acquire it unless the master wishes to give the slave freedom, so in that situation, the master wouldn't just automatically acquire the money, but the money would be used specifically for the freedom. And if the master does not want to go with this, does not want to accept this money for the freedom of the slave, then the money just goes back to whoever donated it.
If the slave is a slave of the master, can he acquire money, providing the agreement is made with the master beforehand? His master agrees that he's allowed to go out and do some business in order to get funds.
Yeah, if the master agrees, then it'll be okay. I mean, according to technical halacha, the money might belong to the master, but the master says, here, feel free to do with it whatever you want. So, practically speaking, it would belong to them.
There have been not only stories, but I think histories of slaves getting very wealthy while they were slaves. So I don't know whether these were Jewish. I don't remember the details.
That's interesting. Okay.
Slaves of Jewish masters.
I think they were Romans.
What?
I think they were Roman slaves. At least I remember stories like that. Uh-huh. Roman slaves, they became very successful in business and whatever.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
No Jews involved
then. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. So that's one way. Another way is bishtar. So the same way that a woman's marriage is dissolved by receiving a document, which we call a get. So the same thing too, there's something called a get shichur, that if the master presents the slave with a document that says, I, so-and-so, hereby release you, my slave so-and-so, from working for me, and you hand it to the slave, then the slavery is dissolved, and the slave becomes a free Jew or goy. Jew. Once the slave has undergone the quasi-conversion, there's no going back to be a non-Jew. The only way to proceed in life is either to remain a slave or to become a free Jew, because there's no such thing as, once a conversion has been successful, so there's no going back to be a non-Jew. It's impossible.
I was having that time with this brother Daniel. Why? Brother Daniel had been a Jew, and he converted to Christianity. And then he wanted to make Aliyah according to the laws of Aliyah, that he's a Jew, because once a Jew, always a Jew. So he applied to the...
Right, but that was meta halachic considerations. That wasn't... Even if a Jew, God forbid, converts to another religion, technically they still remain Jewish. However... You know, that's in terms of a technical halacha. You know, if it's a woman, her children will still be Jewish. If this, even if it's a man, if he gives kiddushin, even if he's a priest, you know, and he goes to a Jewish woman and says haran mikudeshesli and gives her a ring, then they'll be halachically married and she would require a get. That's vis-a-vis that. However, since this person has chosen to separate him or herself from the Jewish people, therefore they cannot expect the privileges
dramatically
of being
and
Jewish,
publicly.
Right?
Well,
sure.
This is basically was the Israeli Supreme Court imposed this upon. You know, they said, "Look, we don't care what your rabbanim say. You know, this guy obviously."
I don't think the rabbanim would agree either.
Well, I mean, but they have to. The question here, obviously, not as his status as a Jew, is whether or not he's eligible to make Aliyah.
Right, so
they say, okay, yeah, he's a Jew, but it's just like, say, Mayor Lansky, you know, okay, yeah, he's a Jew, but we don't want him, you know, so that's the same.
Basically, category. Right, it's like, you know, you've chosen to excise yourself from the Jewish people, so you may be halachically a Jew, but don't come to us asking for a right of return. There's no requirement, the person loses the privileges. The Jews are supposed to, you know, go to great lengths to save other Jews, you know, from trouble. You know, if somebody is taking captives, so the Jewish community is supposed to, you know, raise funds to redeem this person. But if this person is practicing a different religion, so these rules don't apply. You don't have to save them at all. I mean, besides, you know, normal human decency, but
even
the specific.
Though, while he's in captivity, he renounces his conversion.
Oh, so if you have reason to believe that he's sincere, then yeah, then it would apply. Yep. Okay, so a shtar shichrur is another way. If you hand the slave documents, the slavery is ended. And the same thing, which says in Parashas Mishpatim, that if you strike your slave and you destroy certain body parts that will not heal, certain external body parts. So the examples given in the pasuk are a tooth or an eye. But there are other body parts as well, fingers, etc. Okay, so if you destroy these body parts, then the slave goes free. Then kafdal adivarim, there are a total of 24. The avabi shadino lotzeis brashe ivarim she'inan chozrin, tzarech get shichur min ha'ado. Nevertheless, it's not automatic that once he goes, ow, my eye, okay, bye, I'm walking off, I'm free now. No, it's not that it's an automatic thing that the striking causes the slave to become free automatically, is that once you strike the slave, so you're required to write for him a get shichur. The chofin is rabba lechosvelo. You force the slave, the master, to write it for the slave. So if you destroy one of these 24 body parts, then you are forced to write this document, so not analogous to a get, where the husband, under normal circumstances, cannot be forced to write a get for his wife, has to be totally of his own volition. Here, even if the master is screaming, no, no, I don't care what it says in the Torah, you know, I still want him to work for me, even though I destroyed the Rosh Yevarim. So Beis Din takes out their whips, you know, you write the get shichur, and you give it to your slave. So there, I mean, in some ways it's similar in the sense that also when a woman acquires something, so it automatically goes to her husband, but there you can make a deal that basically you could say, Eini zon veini mefarnes, that if the husband says, hey, all right, if you relieve me of my obligation to support you, so I'm going to give up my right to acquire anything that you acquire. So in that such a situation, so a woman could become completely independently wealthy, like your case with a slave, although there it would, in a Jewish context, it would be just an agreement between the master and the slave, where here, according to the strict halacha, the money would belong solely to the wife. A woman, when she gets married, is not in slavery. She's still an independent person. Yeah, you felt like you were in slavery while you were married? Okay. V'amru zichronim levracha shehamocher avdo legoyim o lekusim o lefilu gertoshav yatsa ben chayrim. If a Jew sells his slave to non-Jews or even to Samaritans, because remember, Samaritans are sort of Jewish. Mm-hmm. There was a long period, sort of Jewish. Samaritans, in a certain period in history, were considered to be a wayward part of the Jewish people, descendants of people who converted people from when the 10 tribes were exiled. So the Assyrian Empire brought other people into the northern part of Eretz Yisrael, and there were still some, you know, 10 tribes there, a few stragglers, and they brought these people in, so they were exposed to the Jewish religion, so they basically converted to Judaism. So it's a whole shaila in the Gemara as to whether these people converted sincerely to Judaism, or they converted because there was this plague that lions were coming to attack them. So since, if it was just they converted because lions were coming to attack them, and they said, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, there are lions in our town, in towns and villages, and they're eating us, and I guess the god of this land is mad at us, so we're going to convert to Judaism. So in such a situation, they didn't actually intend to keep the mitzvah, so the conversion would be invalid. And if that was the case, so this opinion of the Gemara says that no, the Samaritans were always never really Jewish, but we paskin that kusim gerei emeshen, that we paskin that the conversion of the Samaritans was originally valid. However, since later on they developed some weird practices that were not in consonance with Judaism, so therefore they were considered to be a second grade Jews. It's an interesting thing that in the Mishnah it even says that if you're eating, there are two Jews and a Samaritan that are eating together, you can have a zimun.
You can have a what?
A zimun.
Well, didn't the Samaritans, they didn't accept Tosha Bal Peh? You know,
they basically did for a while. That was the point originally, yes. But then they, and then at a certain point in history, so their practices became so far from removed from the rest of Klal Yisrael. There's a story in the Gemara about how Reb Meir visited their places of worship on Har Gerizim, which is their central mountain.
The Bama, basically, right? They offer sacrifices on it.
Right, right, right. So he found that there was an idol there, so the rabbis got all upset. So at a certain point, at approximately the year 200 or so, very long time ago, so the Gemara records that the Chachamim decided that, no, we're going to treat the Samaritans as absolute non-Jews. So nowadays, the Samaritans do not have any Jewish status whatsoever, again, unless they would want to convert, but they are now, even though originally they may have been actually Jewish, nowadays they're treated as absolute non-Jews. So if you would have a Samaritan with you in dining in your dining room, you would not be allowed to count him for a Zimun.
What is a Zimun?
Zimun. Rabosai Nivarei. Yeah.
Mezumen.
Okay, yeah, that's what you might call it. Fine. V'amru zichronim levracha. Oh, sorry. So if you sell your slave to a non-Jew, again, an Eved Knani, to a non-Jew, or to a Samaritan, or even to a Ger Toshav, who's number one type of non-Jew in Halacha, who agrees to keep his Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, even though he's a really great non-Jew, and he's going to allow this Eved Knani to maintain his practices as a quasi-Jew, Yotze Ben Chorim. Nevertheless, that is another grounds for this Eved now becoming a free person. Yeah.
This, of course, assuming that the Eved is fully accepted as being an Eved. I mean, so there's a period of a year.
During the period of a year.
Not the year, right. But then once you have to sell him to a non-Jew.
Right, right. So if this Eved goes to the mikvah and becomes a full-fledged Eved Kanani, then yes, if you sell to any type of non-Jew, or even to a Samaritan in the times so they might have been considered Jewish, so Rashi says that this is not a din d'oraisa, but rather this, the Chazal said that since you're likely putting him in a situation where they no longer be allowed to keep mitzvos, I mean, technically, on a d'oraisa level, so an Eved Knani is quasi-Jewish forever, so even if he's working for a non-Jew or a Samaritan, so he still has to keep all the mitzvahs that a slave has to keep. But Chazal said, well, it's likely that the new master will not allow him to keep the mitzvahs that he has to keep. So therefore, we're going to do hefker bezdin hefker, basically. That we're going to abrogate your rights to your property. And where this slave is now going to become a ben chorin. And there's a whole shaila, actually, as to whether when a slave is freed, whether he has to go to the mikvah again in order to complete the full conversion to a free Jew. That's a discussion. I believe we paskin that he does. According to some, maybe the original immersion in the mikvah that he performed when he became a slave is sufficient. He just needs to be nishtachar. Yeah.
Yeah. The question of selling a slave, either a Jewish or a non-Jewish one, is the value of a human being in the slave market considered in cases of, say, nezikin, you know, say, like, death and dismemberment and damages?
Yeah, certainly.
Okay, right. So just like now, for example, if, like, you know, somebody who's, like, you know, 100 years old, you know, gets run over, then the damages are considered a lot less than if there's somebody who's, you know, 30 years old. But in the secular courts.
Anyway. Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah, they think, you know, how much is it, you know, how are their earning capacity and so on and so forth. Yes, they have all these, you know, calculations. But in other words, so it's just analogously then. The value, how much somebody would receive as a slave would be.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Well, too, of course, in the absence of a, you know, current slave market, I guess, that.
Right.
Not possible anything.
Right. And the same thing, if a Jew living in Eretz Yisrael sells a slave to a Jew living in the diaspora, the slave goes free automatically. Because, again, he's supposed to live in Eretz Yisrael like any Jews, even quasi-Jews, so if that's a reduction in status. That even if the master does something to the slave that indicates that he wants the slave to become a free man, then you have to write a get shichur. You have to fully free the slave. You can't have a slave doing these things that seem to be the something that would only be done by a free person. So, for example, if you walk your slave down to the chuppah with a regular Jewish woman, so that's considered to be grounds for requiring you to release the slave. Or you put on tefillin, you help the slave put on tefillin, and tefillin, remember, is a mitzvah that even male slaves are not obligated to do. Or if you say, oh, go take an aliyah. Yeah, and the gabbai says, who's here, who wants chamishi? So no one in the shul wants to take chamishi. So the master says, oh, here. Here, leave the slave chamishi. So if you
what's wrong with chamishi?
It's a little bit of a running joke in the Jewish community. So you know people have this idea in their heads that certain aliyahs are more honorable than others. So shlishi is considered to be a high honor, and shishi for some reason is a high honor. So yeah, okay. Really, technically, the order of aliyahs precedence goes by the what comes first. The first aliyah is the highest honor, and et cetera, until you go down to the last. But
maftir must be higher.
No? Oh no, maftir is the lowest honor actually, because maftir, according to the strict halacha, could even is just an additional aliyah, not part of the requirement, and it could even be done by a child.
Right.
Under bar mitzvah,
supposed to be a big honor.
Rehagba is a big honor too. Yeah.
He'll lift it. Yeah.
Right. So he says, or Rav Shechter always jokes that in the olden days, maftir was considered to be the lowest honor, because even a child can do it. But nowadays, you get to sing away and perform in front of the congregation. So maftir is considered to be one of the highest honors. So really, chamishi should be a higher honor than shishi. And yeah. But for some reason, people have it in their heads that shishi is, maybe I'll be kabbalah, I don't know exactly why. But for some reason, people have it in their heads that shishi is a big honor and chamishi is the lowest of the aliyahs. You give those to someone. So if he says, okay, so give my slave chamishi over here, then the slave would go free or something of that nature. Also, it's interesting that you're not supposed to teach the slave Torah. He's not supposed to go. He obviously has to know the halachos that he needs to know, but if you teach the slave Torah, that's not grounds for freeing the slave, even though you're not really supposed to do it. It's just one.
If you teach your wife Torah, though, then you're still married.
Yep. Yep. Okay. So, if in all these situations, you would require the master to issue a get shichur. And the laws of a get shichur are are similar to the laws of a get for a woman. When a couple's getting divorced, that it has to be written lishma, it has to be written for these, for this specific slave. You can't recycle a get for a get shichur for a slave that had the same name. You can't just take it back and recycle it. It has to be for this specific slave. All these rules, which are similar to a get for a divorce, are also requirements for a get shichur.
By the way. People say the Yemosh Mashiach, is it assumed that all slavery is going to come back into use? Or
Not necessarily. Okay. There's no mitzvah to have slaves, contrary to what the Sefer Achinuch said here, that Jews should have slaves in the Shor Shei HaMitzvah before. So there's no mitzvah to have a slave. You have a slave. Then you have to go LP these halachas. But if you don't have a slave, that's also good.
Well, contrast to a certain other religion, which thinks when the caliphate gets reestablished, of course we're going to, naturally go back to the normal order of things. And
mm-hmm. It's like with the walled cities. So we have all these rules about walled cities when there's a time of the Yovel. So when the Yovel is restored, we're not going to have any walled cities. Okay, so we won't have walled cities. There's no mitzvah to build walled cities. So there's no mitzvah to have slaves. But when you have slaves, you have to go according to these halachas. Now, slavery, actually, this is not actually about a get shichur, but about a get and shichur, that in the Cairo Geniza, there was evidence. I mean, they still had slavery in those times. Jews had slaves. In fact, I remember seeing a get from the Cairo Geniza, which is very interesting in and of itself. A get, I mean, a regular get that was dissolving a marriage, where the fathers of I believe both the husband and the wife, and when their names were written in the get, it said Ben Yosef HaMeshuchrar, meaning that these people who are getting divorced were children of freed slaves. And they were identified as such in the get because that was part of their identity. Just like, someone is a convert nowadays and is part of their identity, so too.
You'd say, right now...
Well, no, nowadays...
Is someone so Ben, Hager or something?
No, no, actually, that's a good point. And again, there have been different conventions throughout the years of exactly how you wrote people's names in Gittin, but nowadays you would not... If the party is the child of a father who was a convert, you would not write the father's status in the get. That's true. You wouldn't write that. But if the person getting divorced is a convert themselves, then you write Ben or Bas Avraham Avinu.
Yeah.
Or Ben or Bas Hagir, the convert, or Hagiris. Either one is fine, although the convention nowadays is, even though both are kosher either way, the convention nowadays is that if the person getting divorced is a convert who is still observant, then you write Ben or Bas Avraham Avinu, and if the person is a non-observant convert who is no longer observant, then you write Hagir, the convert. You don't give him the honor of being called the son of... or daughter of Avraham Avinu, if he's not currently at least Shomer Shabbos.
Can the woman own slaves?
Yeah, I mean there are restrictions. We'll see in a second, but technically.
I understand that in the Cairo Geniza also they talked about women having businesses that belonged to them.
Yeah, that's true. That's 100% true.
If you're talking about if you're freeing a slave, then the slave is the slave and the slave's father, non-Jewish father's name, so it'd be like Donald Ben Fred or something.
No, you wouldn't. You never refer to a Jewish person by the by a non-Jewish father's name.
Oh, I see, right. So the slave is basically
you would say, if you're
sort of Jewish, and so
if you're writing, in the get that I was talking about in the Cairo Geniza was the father who was a Meshuchrar, like I said. So,
and now Trump. You wouldn't say Donald Ben Fred Trump,
You would say. No, but nowadays, if you were writing a get, again, if this were possible, which basically isn't, you wouldn't describe the father this way, but if you were writing the get for someone getting divorced who was a meshuchra themselves, then you would say, Anof was the husband, Shlomo HaMeshuchra, whatever Jewish name there is, or if they didn't have a Jewish name, they still went by the old name, you would say Fred, whatever, HaMeshuchra. Yeah.
A woman free her slaves without consulting her husband?
If she owns them in her own right, yes.
How can she own them in her own right if she is if she has to do what he?
No, if they have if they have an arrangement that she keeps her own money. Saying the normal arrangement is that a woman's money becomes the property of the husband. But if they have an arrangement that she keeps her own money, then she doesn't have to. She can free.
Is that arrangement, by the way, is that put into... How is that arrangement made?
Could be orally. It doesn't have to be unofficial.
Okay, so is that commonly done these days, by the way? I don't recall ever...
Nowadays, we don't. No, people have their own marital arrangements. They don't need...
That's another question. Which is then, let's close for home, a couple's getting divorced, and the wife says, you told me that I could keep my own money. Then, and the husband says, I didn't say anything of the sort. Then what does the beis din do about it?
That's a good question.
If it's oral, I mean, it's not worth the paper it's written on, you know. So.
Yeah, normally it's hamotzi mechavero alav araya, that since the assumption is that the wife's money would go to the husband, so if the wife now wants to extract it from the husband, so then she would have to bring proof.
Premarital counseling should, right? Before, you know,
come on.
Okay, go ahead.
Everybody has their own arrangements now. The Beis Din would take other things into consideration, like what was the... They could look at the financial records from the marriage and they could figure out more or less what was going on. Exactly. Fine. So, v'tzikach tzorech harav lizoyer shelo laso slo mikol elu hadvarim klal. So don't do these things that would indicate that your slave is freed. Kedei shelo yivatel mitzvah sezezek, because you're not supposed to free your slave under normal circumstances. Elim kein asa kein lidvar mitzvah kemoshi pirashnu, unless it was for the needs of a mitzvah, like for they're missing one for the minyan, and you need to free your slave in order to get a minyan. All the rest of the details are found in Maseches Kiddushin and Maseches Gittin.
I'm so puzzled by this idea that getting a tenth for a minyan is so vitally important that you can basically disregard an iser deraisa of feeding a slave. I mean, that just I thought basically, we tend to think, well, if you don't have a minyan, oh, that's too bad. Well, wait till the next time you daven or something like that.
Well, here you have the option of getting a minyan right away. And that Sefer Chinuch explained that the tradition of Chazal is that this mitzvah doesn't apply. B'makom mitzvah. Mm-hmm. So mitzvah d'rabban is also called a mitzvah.
Yeah.
V'nuheges b'chol makom v'chol zman b'zuchar munakevos. It applies in all places and all times for males and females. Afal pisha nekevos also lehen liknos lohen avodim imnei achashad. Again, technically a woman can purchase a slave. However, Chazal said that women should not purchase male slaves because people might look on this transaction with suspicion regarding what kind of services the woman requires this this male slave for.
A man can acquire a female slave.
Yeah.
Because, after all, convert them and marry them if you want.
Right. Well, here's could do the same thing. You could be Mishak for this one.
The relations he has have nothing to do with the status of the marriage, like it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, that's also true. Very clear about that.
Well, even an unmarried woman shouldn't purchase a male slave.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even if she's 100 years old. Maybe, okay. Not that, not, okay, 100 years old, that doesn't mean, They could still, whatever, in permissible ways. Okay. Mikol moko mimkanu osam asulen l'shachron ale yimkaru osam. Nevertheless, a woman could say, she bought a slave, then she comes to my shir, and we're calmly discussing the rules of slave, and I mention that a woman is not supposed to purchase a male slave. Oh no! I violated the halacha. I purchased a male slave. I had no idea. I was totally innocent. I just wanted him to, clean my house and cook for me. So what am I going to do? So then she might think, well, let me just free him. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to free the slave. So, no, you got to sell it. Sell it to, sell him. Sell the male slave to a man. Or get married. Maybe women should get married and then they'll jointly own the slave. Okay. The overall zev shicher avdo shelo lidvar mitzvah k'moshe marinu b'itel ha-seizen. If you freed your slave, so you neglected to perform this positive commandment. Mitzvah Shin Memches, happy mitzvah, Sameach, yeah? 348. Shelo lahaniach legoi lavod bevet ivri anim karlo. We should not allow a non-Jew to engage the services of an Eved Ivri who has been sold to him. Okay. Shelo naniach agoy ashokin bartzoseinu lahavid be'eved ivri shemachar atzmolo. So sometimes, if you're really desperate, a person, again, we saw before that you're not allowed to sell even non-Jewish slaves, Eved Knani, to a non-Jew, but if a Jew is really desperate, needs to sell himself into slavery, and all he finds, the only buyer he finds is a non-Jew, so that transaction is valid. Bavodas Perech, so we should, if there's a non-Jew living in our lands, and he acquired an Eved Ivri, a Jewish slave, again, a born Jewish slave, someone who was born Jewish, not the quasi-converted Eved Knani, so we should not allow him to work his slave strenuously. Shenemar lo yirdenu beferech leinecha. He shall not make him work with bondage to your eyes. Lo nemar achar shezeha ivri over al nafsho machar asma legoin anechenu lizbo kol avoda. So we shouldn't think that we should just, you had to sell yourself to a non-Jew, so you got what you deserved and enjoy your labor, yeah?
This situation is a bit peculiar. Here there's a Jew. Who's so impoverished he has to sell himself into slavery. The Jewish community can't manage to do anything about it. So he finds some non-Jew, sells himself, and now the Jewish community somehow has the power to go ahead and compel this non-Jew how to treat
him. Well, they necessarily didn't have the power to do anything about it. Maybe nobody wanted to buy him.
All right, but still you're saying that the Jewish community now can go around and tell this goy, make sure you're nice to the non-Jew who we didn't feel like, the Jew who sold himself to you and who we didn't think was worth, helping out ourselves.
Maybe.
Well, then we don't really power. The Jewish community, I'm just saying, the power relationship's kind of peculiar here.
I hear. That's a good hara. Ba'amr b'sifra, le'yordenu b'ferech le'inecha, ein ata mitzuve ela le'inecha, kilomar she'in anu chayovim l'chazer olav l'ikonis b'beis lagoy, lirosim yavidenu b'ferech im lo. Ela kozman shenira davar nimne'enu mimenu. So it says, he shall not work him with bondage to your eyes. What does it mean, to your eyes? It means that if you happen to see it, if you happen to see the non-Jewish master saying to the Jewish slave, okay, work really hard, something really, really untenable, then we're required to say something. We're required to prevent that if we have the power to do so, but we don't have to, install spy cams, in the house of the non-Jew to make sure that he's treating the Jewish slave properly. Or, appoint mashgichim to, look in a telescope or, break into the house to make sure that the slave is being treated properly.
What is considered avodas perech?
So, it's a good question. So, I don't know if it has the same halachic definition as that a Jew is not allowed to treat it, to make his ivri work avodas perech, which is referring specifically to something that's really annoying because it has no end point. So avodas perech in that situation doesn't mean that it's something that's really hard, but rather it's something like, say, keep doing this until I come back, and he doesn't know when you're coming back, so just keep doing it forever and ever and ever until you come back. Or you tell him to do something that you don't really need, like just in order to. So I don't think this has the same definition as that. I just think this means that you shouldn't allow the non-Jew to let his to work his Jewish slave really with difficult labor. Shorish mitzvah zo, nigla hula chol rei shemesh, it's obvious they're supposed to take care of our fellow Jews. Dinea kelulim bi'ikara. Okay, so I explained the rules just now. This applies for both males and females at a time where we have the power to somewhat control the actions of the non-Jews. So
it's not Eretz Yisrael, obviously, because the Azar is not allowed to live in Eretz Yisrael.
Well, I mean, when we have the power to get rid of it, but not even of a right. But if we have the power to do this in any place,
it's like a Ger Toshav maybe could own a.
Could be, yeah.
Okay, so
yeah. Sheish banu koach aleim letzavosam lasos davar oshelaso. So when we have control over what the non-Jews are doing, so good. Over al zeh v'ro hagoy mavid haYisrael ba'avodas perech v'yish koach biyado lemanu v'lo minao over belav zeh. Aval ein malkin oso alav levish ein b'maisa. So since it's this issue is a passive violation and not an active violation, So therefore, you do not receive the penalty of Malchus. You just okay. Fine. Mitzvah Shin Mem Tes 349. Shelo nishtachavel even maskis afilu Lashem. We should not bow down on stone floors of a certain kind, even when our intention when bowing down is to serve God, and certainly not Avodah Zarah, God forbid.
Oh, so this is the newspapers on Rosh Hashanah, right? This is the,
yeah, exactly. Shelo nishtachavel even maskis, not to bow down on stone floors, afilu Lashem Baruch Hu, even to God. You shall not place these stone floors in your land in order to bow down upon it. A stone floor with a like a mosaic on it or a some sort of drawing or carving on the stone floor with a decoration.
Oh,
you can't bow down on it. You can't have it. You're not to bow down.
But in a shul you bow down. What do you mean?
Not usually.
What do you mean?
You don't usually bow down on the ground.
It's also being.
What do you mean by?
It doesn't mean like this. Like you're Shmon Esrei, you go like this. That doesn't.
No, that's not considered.
No, no.
Elenu on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we actually get to go down.
Kain avnei gozes migororos mimigera, or you know, stones, little stones that were cut out with a saw or shaved down in some way. Bichlal Isser Evan Maskis. These are all part of the rule of the prohibition of Evan Maskis.
So if you're out in a field or something like that, there have to be a few stones lying around. That wouldn't be a problem.
We show Shia Mitzvah, Kosav Rambam Zichron Avrocha. The Rambam says, Levishoy Osin Kein Lavuda Zara. The Rambam says that God prohibited us from doing this in the Torah because this was a normal act of worship for Avodah Zara, bowing down on stones. Yesivu Avonim Mitzuyaros Bimlocha Noel Ifnei Atzelem. They would put pretty stones in front of the idol, v'hayu mishtachavin aleha lefanov, and they used to bow down.
But it's actually bowing down in front of the stones, like the stone idol. You know, you don't.
You bow down on the stones in front of the idol.
That wouldn't be very,
You bow down on the stones in front of the idol.
Ah, okay.
Even if you bow down to tie shoelaces.
That's more Marasayandic, yes. But that's certainly not allowed. That's true. But that applies even without the Evan Maskis. You can't bend down in front of an Avozar, that's how your shulis says. The Chinuch says, I think you could say else, a different time. There were different reasons from the Rambam. Because it looks like you're bowing down to the stones themselves, that you consider them to be a deity. Since it's a very pretty floor, so you might think, oh my gosh, this floor is so beautiful, I want to worship it. But if you bow down on top of, say, a carpet, a beautiful carpet, it says clothes literally, but a cloth thing, ein sham makom lachashad. There's no reason to suspect you here that you're worshiping the thing you're bowing down on. Nobody would say that the carpet is a deity because the carpet gets worn out very easily, whereas a stone floor lasts for a very long time, so it's more likely to be confused.
But idols also made out of wood. Does wood apply as well as stone here?
No, it only applies to stone, okay. But I guess wood also doesn't last as long as stone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could last a long time. That's a good point. Aval Evan Shudover Kayam Vieshla Sarba Shamayim. That there is an angel that's appointed to be the angel of stones. So you'd be suspected if you bow down specifically on stones. It's like the case that it says in Maseches Chulin. The Mishnah says that if a person shechts for the sake of a mountain, then the shechita is not considered to be an idolatrous shechita.
So the Gemara says,
you can take the animal, and he says, I shech this animal for the sake of this mountain.
What does that mean?
Well, if you say, I shech an animal for the sake of an idolatrous deity, so that's prohibited. Uh-huh. that's considered to be an idolatrous shechita, and that's a prohibitive in banos. So the Mishnah says that that's not considered to be an idolatrous shechita if you shecht for the sake of a mountain. So the Gemara says, wait, why not? That's considered to be idolatrous. It should be considered to be idolatrous because why not? You shechted it for something other than for a power other than God.
The mountain is a god.
So the Mishnah says that no, if you shecht it for the sake of a mountain cannot become an avodah zarah. A mountain is part of the world. A mountain cannot be an avodah zarah. So therefore, is not considered to be a full idolatrous shechita if you shecht for the sake of a mountain. But if you shecht for the sake of an angel that's associated with a mountain or some celestial force that's associated with a mountain, then that would be considered to be a full idolatrous shechita. Yeah?
Now, this idea that, in fact, there are Malchei Asharis who, you know, concern themselves with mountains and stones and so forth, that this seems very troubling. I mean, it seems like it's been...
There's a Malach HaMemuna on certain things.
All right, but that's sort of like, what's the difference between that and the god of stones? You know, I mean,
no, because they have no power of themselves.
Okay, all right.
It just, you know, forces...
A dangerous direction.
Well, we have angels, we have malachim all over Tanakh, so we have malachim, but the point is that in Jewish belief, they have absolutely no independent power. They're just some sort of force that does God's bidding and is a lower level of interaction between God and humans than, you know, direct prophecy.
Like a tooth fairy or something, right?
Okay. So the... So if you shecht for the sake of the god of the har, so for the celestial force that's associated with the mountain, then it's a full idolatrous shechita. So the same thing too. So here, if you bow down to the stone, you might really be thinking about the celestial force that's associated with the stone, and it will be considered to be idolatry, and you'll be suspected of this, and so it's no good.
So all of this applies only if your head actually touches the floor?
Correct. Yeah. We'll see. He'll say in a second. The Torah doesn't want people to be suspected of doing things that are wrong. They might think, hey, you know, this guy bowed down on a stone floor, and, you know, I could do that too. But they didn't know that the first guy had God in mind, and the second guy is going to think, hey, you know, I could bow down to the stone floor too. So he's going to be confused about what exactly was going on over here. Midine a mitzvah, the halachos are as follows. Mashamar zichron lebracha, shein chiyuv malchus b'zeh ela v'pishut yadayim v'raglayim. The biblical prohibition of evan maskis, of a stone floor, is only when you're mamish flat. Not even like we do on Rosh Hashanah. So there are three ways of bowing. There is kriya, which is bowing down on your knees, just getting down on your knees. Then there's hishtachavaya. Use my hand to demonstrate. There's kriya, there's hishtachavaya, which is putting your face on the floor with that position, with your knees on the ground, and you just bend over and put your face on the floor. And there's pishud yadayim viraglayim, which means you're completely spread out on the floor. You're like Superman. You're lying down, literally, just the face down on the floor. So the only thing that is prohibited in Midaraisa says if you literally prostrate yourself on the Evan Maskis. Shenimtza kulo mutal ha-Evan. Your whole body is sprawled on the stone floor. Shekein ba perush ha-Mekubal, shezo hishtachavaya ha-Mura b'Torah. When the Torah talks about hishtachavaya, bowing down, the assumption, unless noted otherwise, that it's talking about completely sprawled. Avalo pishud yadayim v'raglayim, ein bo malkus. Avamakin ha-Osekein makas mardus. And if you just put your knees on the ground and then put your face on the floor, that's called a lesser form of bowing. Kida, I think it's called in other places. So if you do that, then that's prohibited midirabbanan. Okay? Ulinyan avodah zarah ein chilug v'pishu yadayim v'raglayim ela mishah sheyichbosh adam pana bakarka lefaneh niskal. But if you're really worshipping avodah zarah, so then it doesn't matter if you do Pishud Yadayim V'Raglayim, your mom is sprawled, even if you just put your face on the floor, you will receive the penalty of stoning.
But all old synagogues that have been excavated have stone floors, so how did the people...
They didn't bow. What do you mean? Why?
People didn't bow?
Not necessarily, no.
I mean, how can you not bow when you're in a shul, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? I mean,
I don't know if they have. I don't know if they did that. I don't know if they did that 2,000 years ago. First of all, or you put something on the floor. Yeah. Mash Amru Sheim Paras Machzelos Aritzbas Avon Mechisosan Mutar Lishtachavos Alehem. But if you put something
down in between
your face and the floor, then you're allowed to bow down upon it.
If you, like the Hasidim do, if you spit during Shemishtach when you go, does that help anything?
It's a tiny bit of spit, I don't think that would help.
You don't
help.
Want to bow down to that anyway, so no.
Right, it would have to be...
Yes.
Okay.
So you don't... Right, so if you put a rug or something on the floor, then it would be permissible. It's a shayla, actually. There's a stone floor and then a carpet on top. So if it's some contemporary poskim say that if it's a wall-to-wall carpeting, then it's considered to be buttel to the floor. So that would not
help. Would not help?
Would not help. So this floor, this wall-to-wall carpeting, if there are stones underneath, you would not be allowed to bow down on this floor. You would have to be like a temporary covering, one that you could take on and off.
No, the shul has been constructed 100 years ago. How do you know?
So the minhag is that you always put something on the floor when you bow down, even if it's something that would technically be permissible, just to be on the safe side. This is based on other shitas, which if you look in the Shulchan Aruch in the end of Simen Rei Kuflam and Aleph that discusses this, you'll in the commentaries there are other opinions that maybe you're not even allowed to bow down like that, even if it's not a stone floor at all, because it's the Mishnah Berurah says that you need tarte lemaliusa. In other words, it says midaraisa, it's only sprawled on a stone floor. But midarabanan, again, not everybody agrees with this. Everybody agrees that midarabanan, you're not even allowed to bow without being sprawled on a stone floor. But the Mishnah Berurah brings other rishonim that say that you're even not allowed to be sprawled on a non-stone floor. So that's why he says that you need to have either, in order to be permissible, it needs to be both the non-stone floor and not being sprawled. Or if it's another type of floor, then you have to put, if you want to be sprawled, then you have to put an external thing to separate between your face and the floor. And it's actually a common mistake that people make on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that when they put the thing down on the floor to allow bowing, so they put it under their knees.
Keep the knees clean. Yeah.
Right, so that's what my Rosh Hashiva in Israel made that sarcastic comment sometimes. Because when you look around the shul Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you think that people think that the reason you put something on the floor when you bow is in order to keep your pants from getting dirty from the floor. That's not true. I really don't know why people put on their knees. There's no prohibition at all to just kneel without any type of bowing, even on a stone floor. So the real thing that you're supposed to do is to put it between your face and the floor.
So if you get arrested, then you tell the cop, wait, I can't do that, it's Mr. Derisa.
How about you? Well, yeah, if you're not... No, they don't make you go from that. You just make you.
No, they make you spread it. You know, they
lie down on the floor.
Oh, yeah. If they're worried about you having a weapon or something, they will. The whole thing with the Jackrit do, you see it on the shows all the time, and they your hands absolutely flat on the ground. Yeah, your hands out. You know, before they go over.
What kind of floor is it? I mean, pavement isn't really stone.
Well, whatever. I mean, I don't know. It depends on where you're getting arrested.
Yeah. Okay. I never thought of that. That's very interesting. It's very interesting.
I would not. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, don't get arrested. Don't get arrested. That's my psak. Okay? So, yeah, that's something important to keep in mind, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that the thing is really supposed to be whatever you put down, a towel, paper towel, newspaper, whatever. Some people get on your face, the newsprint. I wouldn't recommend the newspaper. But you're supposed to put it between your face and the floor and not your knees in the floor. Fine. So, Umash Amru Zichron Levracha. The sages tell us that the bechol makom who eser chutz min hamikdash. In the base of mikdash, you're allowed to fall down and mamish sprawl yourself on the floor, even though it's stone. Shemuter lishtach avos Hashem al avanim shenamar lo sidnu ba'artzechem. You shouldn't do this in your lands, but not that excludes the base of mikdash from the prohibition. Ba'artzechem yatem mishtachem al tem mishtachem al ha'avanim hamefutzalos ba'mikdash. But you're allowed in the base of mikdash. That people who bow down on stones, he says, this supports my reason, that the reason is that you shouldn't be suspected of considering these stones a deity. But in the Beis HaMikdash, there's no concern that you're going to make the stones of the Beis HaMikdash a deity. Everybody, nobody worships the Avodah Zarah inside the Beis HaMikdash. There's no suspicion of the Avodah Zarah inside the Beis HaMikdash. Ein sham makom lachashad. There's no room for suspicion. That if it's just to distance oneself from things that were idolatrous practices, kol shekin she'aril harchik. So you shouldn't be allowed to bow down in the base of Mikdash either, because you wouldn't want to do anything that's reminiscent of things that are Buddhazardic.
You shouldn't check the animals either. That's
right. But nevertheless, you know, the Rambam was a really big rabbi, and he probably had his reasons. We the listeners to his words, haven't quite figured it out yet. Receive lashes if you sprawl yourself on stones. Veshomer mishva mitzvah ashrav. We finished the parsha of Bahar. We'll continue Meretz Hashem in 2 weeks with Parshas Bechukosai.